I'm Duncan McLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast brought to you today by Mimecast. Now, it gives me great delight to welcome Brian Pinnock back to the podcast. Brian is Director of Sales Engineering at Mimecast in the Middle East and Africa. Brian, when you and I last spoke, I think it was quite early in South Africa's COVID-19 lockdown, and we spoke about the security implications of the lockdown. I think a lot of water under the bridge since then. But today we're going to be talking about something else entirely. We're going to be talking about privacy legislation, specifically the Protection of Personal Information Act, or PAPIA, or PAPIA, and also, to some extent, I guess, the European GDPR regulations. So I think everyone by now has heard of PAPIA, or the Poppy Act, as it's also known. But who does it affect, Brian? Is it companies across the board, or any certain industries? Who should really be concerned about this legislation?
So thanks, Duncan. Thanks for having me on again. So PAPIA is quite an interesting one. So is GDPR, for that matter. What makes PAPIA different to GDPR is and similar laws like GDPR is GDPR and similar laws look at who are the data subjects. They're worried about where they actually are, whereas Poppy is more, or PAPIA, and we all struggle with that because we're so used to calling it the Poppy Act, is more sort of focused on where the organization is domiciled and where the data is processed. So that's probably the simplest way to look at who's actually sort of has to comply with PAPIA. Most organizations in South Africa, there's very few that don't. I think there's a list of a few sort of government-type organizations. So there's some exemptions, like if you're a public body that protects national security or you prosecute offenders. I think the cabinet's exempt for some strange reason and various things like the courts and that. But yeah, by and large, most organizations that are domiciled in South Africa have to comply with PAPIA. And if they process data in South Africa, they have to comply with PAPIA.
Interesting. So the politicians managed to make themselves exempt, right?
As usual, yes.
All right. So it's interesting that the Poppy Act is coming in at this particular juncture. And I know it's got nothing to do with the COVID-19 pandemic, and that it was always planned that it would be introduced, at least the first phases of the legislation be introduced this year and come into full effect in 2021. But I imagine, Brian, that a lot of companies right now are thinking, you know, we've been through a hell of a year. In many industries, companies are struggling to survive. I think many have, in fact, gone to the wall because of the lockdown already. And I think company directors are saying to themselves, you know, we've got a lot on our plates right now. We're fighting to survive. It's a tough economy. Do I really need to bother with all of this new legislation, this Poppy Act? Is this not just a complete waste of my time? Given the environment, given the stresses and other challenges facing company directors right now, can they afford to sit back and say, well, actually, you know, let's just ignore this?
So that's a really good question. It's one that actually comes up quite a bit. We often hear people saying, you know, why all this attention on privacy and data processing? You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic and one of the biggest economic crises this country's faced in, you know, decades. And I think you kind of summed it up. The Act has actually been in the making for a very, very long time and has been around in a sort of half-baked form for a while as well. Right now, we're in a kind of a grace period. And I think it's important that organizations don't see it as something that needs to be done. I think there's a couple of issues that pop up in that sort of question. The first one is, if you're not that familiar with the Act, what many organizations, particularly small ones, don't realize is, in the absence of actually assigning a data privacy officer, the CEO is responsible, becomes the responsible person, who is then subject to the fines and the prison terms, which are highly unlikely, but you know, there is a risk associated with that. So that's the first one. But again, I think it's a very negative way of looking at it. What one needs to do really is take an approach that says, you know, we're moving into an era, particularly now with a pandemic, having been this kind of digital accelerant, and rather use PAPIA as an approach to benefit your businesses and your clients and improve the way you manage and handle data. PAPIA and GDPR are not identical, but they both spend a lot of time talking about data governance, which, if done well, is very much a good thing. So whether your business is heavily focused on your customer relationship management system, your enterprise resource planning system, or HR, or whatever the case is, it's important to get all the data right and get all these things right. I think maybe one of the ways, if you kind of reframe it and think about privacy data as not belonging to you. So maybe a good analogy would be to say, Think about your customers, suppliers, and employee data as their asset. You know, if you're going to take your car in for a service, you know, you want to know who's going to be working on it. You want to know that somebody's not going to drive it over the border into Mozambique. You want to know that you're going to get it back when you come in the afternoon to fetch it. And you want to know that someone else is not going to be given your car. That's kind of fairly obvious. It's your asset. It belongs to you, and they just happen to be working on it. And if we think about information as an asset, and you would then treat your clients and other, you know, assets in the same, treat their data as an asset, then it becomes a lot easier to kind of think about how to deal with POPIA and comply with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting analogy that I think that and I think you're right, Brian. I think many companies sort of take the approach that, you know, this is a carrot and stick thing. We are, you know, they're quite grudging about it, and they say, well, we have to do it, otherwise we are going to get fined if something happens, blah, blah, blah. I could get into trouble myself as a CEO or director of this company if I don't comply with the legislation. But a view I'm increasingly hearing is that actually this is a potentially a good thing for the company, for companies, because it'll help them to think through what it is they need to do from a data protection perspective, and it'll help them actually to think more about how they use data within their organizations and possibly help them improve as an organization their processes, their systems, etc., and ultimately come out of it at the end of the day not only with a system that is POPIA Act compliant, but also potentially improve their organization in the process.
I think absolutely, and one of the elements of POPIA is actually, and we're going to talk about this, I guess, in a little while, is security, and they talk about how to secure personal information, but while you're busy securing personal information, you can also secure your entire organization, and I think one of the things that happened during this pandemic is there's been this, you know, as much as there's been a step change in the way we've handled the, you know, sort of moved up in the sort of digitization of the way we do things, there's also been a step change in the threat landscape. We've seen all kinds of, first of all, just sort of volume level, the number of threats increased dramatically, but the type and the volume and all kinds of things have gone up. And unfortunately, most organizations, due to some of the things you mentioned earlier, they're just sort of really busy just trying to keep the lights on and keeping their heads down and keeping the business going, haven't had time, all the inclination, all the money to actually improve their security postures. And I think this is also, over time, going to be a very good thing to get organizations to kind of align their security posture with the way the threat landscape has now moved.
We've seen quite a lot of data breaches being reported in recent weeks, the latest, of course, being a large financial services company. I understand that under the POPIA Act, you're actually required to report data breaches to the information regulator. Does this mean that we're going to see a big spike in the number of data breaches in South Africa purely because companies are required to report them?
I think we absolutely will. We saw something similar with GDPR. Is in the first year, in fact, in less than the first year, it was probably in the first 6 months, there was a law firm, DLA Piper, if memory serves, did a report within the first 6 months of GDPR being live, and they actually came up with some very, very interesting results. First of all, there was this massive spike in data breaches of various kinds. But what to me was a lot more interesting was the different countries seem to report the volume of data breaches very, very differently. Mm. So you had countries like the Netherlands and Germany who are, and the United Kingdom for that matter, so maybe I'm about to undermine my own sort of observation here, but certainly the countries that are very, very focused and law-abiding tended to sort of report their data breaches in very, very large numbers, even relatively trivial ones. And then you had countries like Italy who, in terms of, you know, if you kind of normalize it in terms of head of population, we're really sort of, you know, just to give you a contrast, I think Italy reported about 600 odd data breaches in the same time Netherlands reported 15,000 data breaches. Wow. So just to give you a kind of sense of the difference. So, yes, I think we're going to see something like that, and you're going to see large organizations, particularly like the big financial services organizations, which have to be conservatives and very sort of risk averse, are going to be reporting data breaches in greater numbers. Although, as you say, what we've started seeing a lot, almost starting with the Liberty breach that happened a number of years ago, is those kinds of organizations actually doing a really good job of getting out ahead of it in spite of the legislation not being in place and really sort of taking the view that, you know, this is not our data, this is our client's data, and these are the sorts of steps we're taking to ensure a breach doesn't happen, and this is how we've controlled it, and this is, you know, what's going on, and really just sort of keeping the communications going. We've seen it recently, the financial services company you mentioned recently one of the large retail banks, if we're talking about the same breach, I think also did a really good job of getting out there early, getting ahead of it. That was an insider data leak more than a breach. But certainly that would be commended for doing stuff without necessarily having to comply with the law, just doing kind of what's right.
Yes. You're right. It was a data leak. They were quite clear that none of their systems were breached in that incident. Does it affect all companies, though, Brian? What about small companies? And I'm thinking particularly of startups here that, in the tech space, if you create an app, you're immediately collecting information when someone signs up and types in their credentials. Does it affect them as well if they suffer some sort of data breach or data leak? Do they also have to report it to the information regulator, or does it only impact larger organizations?
So unfortunately, it impacts everybody, and that's actually the challenge, is the kind of data governance and privacy kind of framework that a large retail bank would put in place with huge investment in time and people and data classification and security policies and all of the things that go with it is obviously very, very different in scope and scale to a startup of, say, sort of 8 or 10 people.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they've all got the same requirement to, first of all, protect the data, second of all, have all those data governance activities in place, and then also then report any form of a breach that happens.
Interesting. So, I mean, it's going to be more of a challenge for those smaller organizations. To what extent can they rely on their service providers, for example, their cloud partner, to provide that protection for them?
So I think that's what a lot of organizations are going to try and do is outsource the problem to some extent. Mm. And that's not going to be entirely possible. So, we've seen it now. We see it as Mimecast at the moment. We're starting to get for what are called DPAs, data processing agreements. And a lot of companies are trying to kind of write in, probably let's take a step back and actually talk about some definitions. So in Papir, we talk about the responsible party. That's the organization, that's typically the company that, the startup in this example. In GDPR, they call that the data controller. In South Africa with Papir, we call the party you try and outsource some form of data processing to, like Mimecast, for example, be the data operator. And you can't actually take any of your obligations as a responsible party and pass them on to the operator. Mm. What you can do is ensure that the operator does certain things like alert you to the fact within a timeous manner that there has been a data breach of some kind or some kind of downtime or whatever the case may be. You can actually ask your responsible party to ensure that they process their data within a specific legal jurisdiction. And so there are some things you can do, but at the same time, you can't try and outsource all of your sort of obligations under the law.
So you need to ensure that your third-party provider is actually complying with POPIA or the GDPR. It's not good enough to say to them, please ensure you comply with this legislation. You have to make sure they're doing so.
Yeah, and there's some shortcuts one can take. I mean, obviously, and it depends on a number of factors, how much money you've got and how much kind of outside counsel you can get in. But one of the simplest ways to ensure that particularly large cloud providers are compliant is instead of giving a checklist of a huge number of security controls to have in place, check and see if they already have something that's even more substantial than that, like ISO 27001, which essentially is a data processing set of standards that most of the large cloud providers will adhere to. There's a whole bunch of them, SOC 2, Type 2, and, familiarize yourself to a sort of a degree with those and then rather rely on those and trying to create things from scratch. But it is certainly something that is going to be challenging for small organizations. And it's going to be dangerous to assume that as a small organization, you're kind of going to be able to fly under the radar and assume that it's just the big retail banks and the financial services companies and maybe the health companies in the health sector that are going to be more exposed. I think they will be, but I think the regulator is going to try and make examples of, first of all, large organizations, if they are, turn out not to adhere to the POPIA Act, but even a small organization who has a breach of a large amount of data. We've seen a few of those in the past few years, one of which was the Deeds Office breach, yes, where I can't remember the exact number there, but it was, in 30 plus million South Africans, very, very sort of critical data was actually sort of left out in the wild. And I mean, it was a relatively small company that was involved in that. And I think the information regulator would certainly make an example of a company that had, put everything on, say, an unsecured S2 bucket on US without you know, putting any kind of controls and security in place. I don't think you'll get away with that, even if you are a small company.
Yeah, I think that company was very fortunate that that happened before Poppy Act. I think I prefer Poppy Act, before Poppy Act came into force, because they would have been in a lot of trouble, right?
Yeah, I think the regulators actually gone to great trouble to ask us to pronounce it Poppia, but I'm actually right there with you. I can't get Poppy out of my head, so we can go with Poppy Act.
Let's call it Poppy Act. It's much, much easier, Brian. What should the key focus areas be for companies that are looking at the Poppy Act and perhaps haven't started work on this? I suppose securing your data is the most important thing.
There's a couple of ways you can look at the Poppy Act. Probably the best one is to look at the 8 conditions for lawful processing, because it kind of breaks it up into the various categories and kind of links up to the way the Act works. So just to go through those very quickly, and then we can zoom in on one or two. So sure. The first one is accountability. And that basically is what I referred to earlier, saying it requires, you know, an organization to have an information officer. And if you don't, well, then your CEO is one by default. So if you're a small company and you're the CEO of the small company, good luck to you. You're now the information officer. Most large organizations will either give it to the chief security officer, chief information security officer, or the CIO. But small companies, don't have those functions. It'll be the CEO. The part that a lot of people don't realize, particularly, again, small startups, is the processing, because this is another kind of condition, is your processing has to be adequate, relevant, and excessive in relation to purpose. So if you are selling an insurance policy and you collect a whole bunch of my data, you can't then use my data to try and do some kind of data mining and on-sell that data in some other way, which a lot of small organizations, again, may want to kind of monetize the data they got because, data is the new oil and all of that. Mm. So that's something to be aware of. You've also got to be very clear that of the purpose. So you've got to be very specific about what you're doing. So you shouldn't actually keep data longer than necessary. So that's another thing where we've had people holding on to data for years and years and years. And in fact, it's something we're starting to see now in the archiving world. Is in the past, Mimecast used to, well, we still do have a 99-year kind of bottomless archive and keep as much information as you like for as long as you like. Mm. And a lot of organizations are now turning around and saying, what we need to do now is actually have policy-based retention. So some information we'll only keep for as long as our industry vertical requires us, whether it's finance or health or whatever. And other organizations saying no longer than X period of time, but almost nobody is just keeping everything forever anymore. And that's, largely because data is now not just seen as something you hang on to. It's also, there's a whole bunch of risks associated because of the regulation. So that's the third kind of condition. The fourth one is and it's kind of related, I guess, to some of the others, is the processing's got to be consistent with the original purpose you used it for. It's got to be complete, accurate, and not misleading. And then you've got to make everybody aware. You've got to make subjects aware of what of how you're collecting it, what the source is, what the purpose is, whether, what laws it's subject to, whether it's stored or processed in another country, all of those kinds of things. And those ones are kind of interesting and useful, and I think they're kind of good to get your head around. But the last two, to me, are the most important and second most important. So sort of the seventh condition is something called security safeguards, which I would actually argue is probably the most important condition. And 8 is this concept of data subject participation, which is the ability for people to kind of check in and say, what data do you have about me? Can I, change it? This is where the right to be forgotten, et cetera, comes in. So those 8 conditions are probably where one should start and, get your head around it. And of those 8, the last 2 are the most important.
I suppose one challenge, Brian, is simply going to be figuring out where all of your data is, because many companies don't know. There are so many systems, especially in larger organizations, with data stored in all sorts of places, in personal cloud drives, in email particularly, in ERP systems, in classical databases. It's all over the place. How do you ensure that you are protecting all of this stuff? Is some sort of audit needed to determine what data you actually have?
So absolutely. I think it's very, very necessary, first of all, to understand, and I always, when I talk to organizations, talk to them about, look at it in two large pieces. First of all, there's your structured data, which, as difficult as it is the easier of the two. So the structured data will be things like your customer relationship management system, all of your standard databases, everything that you have as your sort of business systems, your sort of business operational type systems. Where it gets a lot more challenging is some of the things that you alluded to is your unstructured data. And there's a misconception that you don't have to worry about that, and you very much do. So if you look at like emails, look at things like your shared drives, look at things like, you know, just the people's, you know, data that's just sitting on people's devices, all of that information is actually and needs to actually still be considered within an overall information and privacy architecture. So it's critical to understand where it all is. And the harder of the two is really the unstructured data, with email being a big part of that.
Yeah, I was just about to ask about email because email is traditionally a very non-secure platform. It was never developed with security in mind. And of course, this is where Mimecast is particularly strong as an organization. What solutions does Mimecast actually offer in this space that would help organizations to secure their email, to ensure that their email systems are actually, in fact, compliant with the POPI Act?
So I think the first thing to make clear is we can offer tools and systems that can help you become compliant. We can't make you compliant. Only you can do that. Right. But critically, what we do from an email perspective is we offer a true email archive in the sense that it's an archive which is not part of your existing, whether you're on-premise or cloud-based email. So it's a true archive because it's a third-party complete copy of the data. And that's quite critical to understand. What we do is we obviously protect that and encrypt it. So when the data is at rest, it's encrypted with, there's various different encryption algorithms. I don't have to go into the details of that. But the real sort of abilities that we give organizations is the ability to classification on the fly. So as data comes in, you can determine that this is information. I'll give you an example. So let's say you put a policy in place on your email system to say every time somebody sends in something that looks like a CV, it's got an ID number, it's got a curriculum vitae or resume or something written on it, it's in PDF or other format, what we'll do is we'll tag it. And what we can even do is automatically, if you want to, put a retention on there for, let's say, only 6 months. The idea behind that would be that if somebody applies for a job, well, presumably within 6 months, you'll give them a job, but you certainly don't want to be hanging on to their private information for any other reason thereafter. Mm. And if they come back to you 7 months later and say, please prove to me that you no longer have any of my information, you can actually show that this data has actually been deleted. There's an audit trail, which again is quite critical, is this ability to actually show an audit trail of what you've actually done in your systems.
Interesting. Now, we chatted just before we started recording, Brian, about immutability. Now, I've heard this term used before in reference to the blockchain, the immutable blockchain, immutable transactions on the blockchain. What does it mean in the context of data, and why is it important?
So in the context of data, I'll tell you why immutability is important. So immutability is very obvious. When you go and talk to organizations, say, look, you know, You need to have an archive, and they say, right, yes, we absolutely do, and it needs to be immutable, and you give them a whole bunch of reasons. So let's just say you're a financial organization, you want to make sure that your brokers can't do any nefarious deeds and then hide their tracks. And they go, absolutely, we need immutability. Or if somebody's involved in some kind of an HR incident, let's say it's sexual harassment, whatever the case may be, the last thing you want is for them to be able to get hold of an email administrator and delete emails. I mean, one thing not a lot of people are even aware of is if you don't have a true archive, an average end user, if they're just slightly skilled, can actually go onto their email client like Outlook and actually modify an email. So I could send an email to you calling you all kinds of derogatory names and then change that email later on. And then there's two copies of the email, the one that you've got and the one that I've got. And right. There's no way of proving whether you changed that email or whether I changed the email. Mm. So you could be falsely accusing me, or I could be hiding my tracks, and there's no way of telling. And until you actually have a third-party archive, you don't actually have a way to kind of resolve that impasse. So that's a critical part about immutability. You don't want any form of fraud. I mean, particularly in South Africa and particularly in public sector, but not only in public sector, you know, we've got these issues of corruption that you need to try and ensure there's no more certainty that the people can't hide their tracks in email. And that's where the immutability side of things needs to come in. And most email platforms, including some of the large cloud providers, can actually give you email immutability. The challenge with immutability, though, is what happens when you have one of the provisions of POPIA, which is the last one, which is the data subject participation, where someone legitimately comes in and says, I'm no longer doing business with your organization, or you're holding data of mine in, you know, incorrectly. It's, you know, you've got my ID number wrong or my age wrong or my health status, whatever it might be, and I want you to change it. If you've set up your system to be immutable, well, then you've got a problem because you can't actually then be compliant with POPIA or GDPR or one of these other privacy regulations.
Interesting. So what's the solution?
So the solution actually is a tool like ours, which can actually allow you to actually do both and then do it with an audit trail. So without sort of knocking the competition too harshly, they're actually unable to. So if you let's look at the sort of various ways one could do that. So one of the ways you could do that is to not have an archive but actually have a backup and say, well, one thing that I do have is the ability to back things up. The challenge with that, though, is if you do have a subject access request where someone says right to be forgotten, do you have the ability to go through every single backup set and ensure that that person is deleted out of the backup? So that's why it's easier to work with archives than it is with backups. But if you set your archive up to be immutable, well, then you've got a problem. You can't actually unlock that. And that's really due to the fact that a lot of these systems were actually not architected to be archives in the first place. They really were architected simply to be email servers. And in fact, if you look at Office 365 as sort of just an example of one, their so-called archive is actually really just a form of inbox cleanup. So it's a second mailbox that gets created in the cloud, and things get moved from mailbox to mailbox, literally all that happens. And so that's why they had to sort of build in these concepts of litigation holds and retention locks. But once those retention locks are in place, there's no way of removing them. And that's, you know, that's problematic. The way we work is very different. What we do is, it's pretty much always use the example of the nuclear codes. No single person can just sort of fire off a nuclear weapon. It requires at least two people with the keys to simultaneously agree that this is happening. And then there's an immutable audit trail, and that's the part that always stays. So, yes, you might delete data, but there's always an audit trail of exactly who deleted it, exactly when, and who was involved in that data deletion. And it's only administrators with very, very specific high-level privileges that can do that. Mm-hmm.
So a lot to think about there, Brian, and a lot of food for thought for companies. I think you may have scared one or two people with some of your insights here today, but there is still time, right? It's the legislation came into effect this year, but is not enforced until the middle of next year. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So we've still got 6-odd months to go. And in fact, quite a few things one can do already just to get things in place. You know, there are a few quick wins. If you look at the POPIA legislation, it uses, I forget the exact terminology, but it uses this concept of reasonableness, which is, you know, basically what they talk about is you need to take reasonable measures to identify reasonably foreseeable risks, I think is the way they kind of, you know, use the language. And there it's kind of interesting. So if you have a set of tools, a set of data, security controls, and you're seeing in the media that there's data breach after data breach after data breach of this particular way of doing things, well, then I think there'd be a strong case to be made that you actually could have reasonably foreseen that your data was going to get breached. However, if you flip that around and put in very strong security controls, did a whole bunch of things to ensure that you were keeping up with the changes in the threat landscape, I think if you then suffered a data breach, you would be in a very good position to argue to the regulator. And I've had some legal opinion on this, and most problem with this is nobody knows for sure, but most people argue, most of the attorneys that I've spoken to argue that if you've put reasonable steps in place in terms of sort of technical and operational measures, and they're defensible, that you're not going to get into too much trouble with a regulator.
Fascinating chatting to you as always, Brian. Brian Pinnock is Director of Sales Engineering at Mimecast in the Middle East and Africa. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to Tech Central today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.